KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The Seattle Times' John Talton will join us later in the hour to talk about what's happening with manufacturing and what it means for our region. You heard in the news report what was happening with Boeing orders. We're also going to talk with Robert Horton about road movies and what we learn when we take to the road movie. And we start with Vaughn Palmer, who is political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. But next time he decides to head over to Ashland, it may be that he may just have to pay a toll to come into America. Yeah. Hello, Vaughn.
Hello there. I know you guys are tight for dough down there, and I see they're talking about charging Canadians for coming south.
Yeah. Have they listed a price for that yet?
I have not seen an actual fee yet, although it's the mere talk of such a thing. I heard the mayor of Bellingham on Vancouver radio yesterday talking about this and expressing understandable concern, since such a big chunk of any border town is cross border shopping. So I would think this will not go over well. You could just travel right across the North American continent, and every border town is not going to be happy about this thing.
So, Vaughn, all right, well, we won't charge you too much. Tell me about the first gaffe of Mr. Trudeau.
So the young Trudeau, the son of his father's son, who was Pierre Trudeau, who was Prime Minister of Canada. So the son becomes leader of the Liberal Party. And the expectation was that, you take on one of these jobs, you get a lot of scrutiny. He's charismatic. Would he also prove to be someone of substance? He's had his first gaffe. Here he is, the day of the bombing of the Boston Marathon. So this is the day of the bombing. We know nothing except there's been a bombing. We don't know who did it. He says, we have to look at the root causes, but there is no question, note that, there is no question that this happened because there is someone who feels completely excluded, completely at war with innocence, and at war with a society. And our approach has to be, where do those tensions come from? That has been marked down in the book as a gaffe because of the root causes reference, because of this, him saying, before we knew anything, that there was no question that it was a case of someone who felt excluded from society. He hasn't apologized, as far as I know, but it's been, as I said, marked down in the book as a gaffe. Interesting, too, a lot of Canadian media have contrasted that with what his father, Pierre Trudeau, said back in 1970 when Trudeau, the father, was prime minister, and the terrorist Quebec separatists snatched a diplomat and a cabinet minister off the streets and killed one of them, right? This is Trudeau, the father, on terrorism. Nothing that either the government of Canada or the government of Quebec has done or failed to do now or in the future could possibly excuse any injury to either of these two innocent men. The guns pointed at their heads have FLQ, that was the terrorist organization. The guns pointed at their heads have FLQ fingers on the trigger should any injury result. There is no explanation that could condone this act should there be harm done to these men. The government of Canada promises unceasing pursuit of those responsible. Nothing about root causes in there, or people feeling excluded from society. Whatever one thinks of Prime Minister Trudeau, he was not a bleeding heart on that issue.
No, even as you sent an article, he talks about bleeding hearts and reminds bleeding hearts that blood was shed.
Yeah, he sent the army into the streets in 1970 and said, there are a lot of bleeding hearts around who don't like to see people with helmets and guns. All I can say is go ahead and bleed. It is more important to keep law and order in your society than to be worried about weak-kneed people who don't like the looks of. Reporter interrupted him at that point and said, at any cost, how far would you go with that? How far would you extend that? And Trudeau said, just watch me. Well, one of his most famous quotes. So on this one, the son is clearly not the son of the father. He got his ideas about excusing terrorism with root causes and people feeling excluded from other sources.
Well, we'll have to see what he learns from that little episode, because it's been well covered. Tell me something.
Yeah, and he's new at his job, Steve, and you acknowledge that young people, you know, he's 41 years old, but he's brand new to the job of leading a national political party. You know, you watch, I think always with politicians, you watch to see if they learn from their mistakes. So he's had a bad launch. We'll see.
Any updates on the terror plot that the RCMP announced?
Yeah. Yes, so this is an interesting one, and actually the most interesting story on this is in the Wall Street Journal today, at least that I've seen. So the Canadian and U.S. officials were cooperating on an investigation of a terrorist plot that was based in Canada. Two people suspected of planning to blow up a passenger train running between the city of Toronto and the city of Montreal. And the RCMP on Monday of this week busted the two of them, arrested them. They've been in court. They've been charged with conspiracy under Canada's laws. But the interesting story that's in the Wall Street Journal today is that, and this makes kind of sense in a way, that American and U.S. And Canadian officials were cooperating, and the American officials had asked the Canadians to hold off, that they wanted to complete the American side of the investigation, and, you know, maybe you find some other people that are involved in the network. But the Canadian officials insisted on moving on Monday, at least partly because of the fear of an attack. You know, I think that is highlighted by what happened in Boston, which is the authorities are in a tough position always, Steve, I guess, when they have suspicions. And even though an attack is not necessarily imminent, they feel better safe than sorry. So the Canadians moved on Monday. As it happened, you know, that was a day that the Canadian government had scheduled a debate in our parliament on terrorism, a debate that was keyed to what happened in Boston. So there's a suspicion that there was a political dimension, but I don't know. I think if the authorities decide to act, I hope they didn't derail the investigation in the U.S. too significantly, but I think you can understand how in the wake of Boston our authorities may have decided they better be safe than sorry.
Well, officials say the target of the alleged attack was the train that runs between New York City and Canada via rail and Amtrak, New York City and Toronto route.
Yeah.
Now they're talking about increasing security on that train, and the people in charge of the train saying, look, we are always vigilant. Any as in America, any calls in Canadian Parliament for investigation, for that sort of thing?
I mean, this is a very disturbing development here, as is the Boston Marathon one, because there's a couple of we're early in the story yet here in Canada, but there's a couple of elements that as with the Boston story are disturbing. These appear to be homegrown terrorists in a way. One of them, according to the National Post newspaper this morning, was actually charged with uttering threats back in the 1990s and managed to secure a pardon for that. So he was, to some degree, off the radar. So here he is again. The other element of the Canadian story that I think is we should draw attention to and that's significant is that the RCMP on Monday made a point of singling out the assistance they got from leaders in the Muslim community, that some of the evidence, some of the concerns were brought to the police by leaders in that community. So, you know, they praised the community for cooperation, but you still have the issue, as has been raised in Boston, which is sort of homegrown people radicalized who basically get their information over the internet on how to make bombs, and then decide to basically operating on their own. They're their own little cell. They're not necessarily. There's allegations here in Canada of links to Al Qaeda and so forth, and we haven't seen all the evidence come out on that yet. But there is also that element that we have in Boston, which is to some degree this is a homegrown terrorism.
They're also saying that these two alleged terrorists were good recruiters. That was part of their role, was recruiting and getting other people into the act.
Yeah, and as I said, we're very early in the storyline. I mean, I've seen yesterday's stories and then today, and the Canadian authorities have not put out nearly as much information as has been put out in the United States either. So we're you know, that web of speculation and rumor that always surrounds these stories is probably more pronounced here because we haven't had as much information put out yet. There were brief appearances in court yesterday, and one of the things that the judges did in court yesterday was they imposed a ban on publication, so at the request of the defense lawyers. So even some of the stuff that was said in court, we don't have access to that in Canada.
All right, Vaughn, let's shift before we're done here to this other topic. John Kerry, U.S. Secretary of State now. Yeah. The British Columbia mining interests and a U.S. river. What's happening?
Yes. Well, I've been remiss in mentioning this in the last few weeks because the story's been developing for a while, but you have environmentalists on this side of the border writing essentially to the U.S. Secretary of State, raising concerns about pollution emanating from coal mines in British Columbia but flowing across the border. In the Kootenay River, flows down the Lake Coconusa. So the pollution is ending up in the United States, particularly in the state of Montana. As I said, this story has been developing here for the last little while. There hasn't been an awful lot of action on this side. And I think environmentalists are taking the concern across the border because they're hoping that the U.S. State Department will come back through the to Canada through the International Joint Commission, which is supposed to monitor things like this across the Canada-U.S. border. You probably recall we've talked about it with the pollution flowing from the smelter in Trail, British Columbia, that
yes.
flows across into Washington State. The British Columbia government has also asked the company, issued a ministerial order requiring the company to submit a plan for dealing with the prime pollutant here, which is selenium. And since we're in the middle of a provincial election here in British Columbia, this is being handled at the ministerial level, but it hasn't intruded into the campaign as an issue yet. But I would think within that region, in southeastern British Columbia, there at least it'll be an issue raised by the opposition candidates there.
All right, then. We'll see how they fight. They're going to spend some money on it, they say, $600 million for the next 5 years to reduce the pollutants. But
yes.
Some people say that's not going to be enough.
Yeah, no, it's a serious issue, and you know it has the echoes of the earlier one we had, which has been going on since the 1920s, I believe, involving the Trail smelter. So another one.
All right, sir. Vaughn, over the years, it's been a pleasure talking with you. I get to talk to you every week. Starting next week, I will not be talking to you for a good long time. I hope you have a fine time. It's been always fun being on the radio with you.
It's a pleasure being on with you, and it's not because you're not speaking to me. It's because you're taking a leave, is my understanding.
That's right. I'm going to take a leave.
But you will be back.
That's my plan. That's the plan I have. All right.
All the best in whatever you decide to do, and I expect we'll talk again someday.
Yes, sir. And, of course, next week you're talking to Marcy, so you're still there. We'll talk to you again.
Still there.
Yeah, you're still there. Okay. Vaughn Palmer.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. He's a political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. He joins us every Wednesday and has for many years on weekday on KUOW Seattle.
10:18. Road trip movies in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Fuller Theological Seminary Northwest, offering master's degrees in theology and divinity at its Seattle campus, multi-denominational with on-site and online class schedules to fit busy lives. Next information session is on May 4th. Information at fuller.edu/northwest.
56 degrees and sunny in Seattle. Forecast says sun all day with an afternoon high of 68. More sun tomorrow with a high of 64. And then Friday, some clouds coming in. It's 10:19. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Chris Hansen's plans for Soto, Boeing's Dreamliner, and unemployment trends. A look at business and economics in the Puget Sound region in 20 minutes.
Here we go again, Junior.
We're off on the road to Morocco. This taxi is tough on the spine.
Beats the bus, huh, Junior?
Beats me.
Where we're going,
why we're going, how can we be sure?
I'll lay you 8 to 5 that we meet Dorothy Lamour. Off on the road to Morocco. Hang on till the end of the line. I hear this country's where they do the dance of the seven veils. We tell you more, but we would have the censor on our tails. We certainly do get around like Webster's.
Yeah, Hope and Crosby, they're on the road. We're on the road today with Robert Horton. On the road for road movies.
Like Webster's Dictionary, they're Morocco bound.
It's like, that is a good line.
I feel
line.
Like that. I like that. I feel like that clip is the way we are every Wednesday morning, Steve. Just jaunty. Riding a camel.
Hoping to meet Dorothy Lamour. Expecting to meet Dorothy Lamour.
Yep.
Do you consider the road movies? In the way we're defining a road
I'm going to go along with it, yes. Yes. I have a real soft spot for Hope and Crosby and the road movies. I don't know why.
Because in a sense, they feel the way the Rat Pack movies were supposed to feel 10 years later.
Yeah.
They're just kind of, hey, we know we're making a movie. We're just having a good time.
Yes.
Plot?
Yes.
Plot? We'll get to plot.
The camera is rolling, and we're going to say stuff that wasn't necessarily written down. And
don't worry about the plot.
You get that from the movie. Yeah, they're pretty fun, I think.
Can you define a road movie for me?
It's a movie where people hit the road. And,
done.
And that's from there, you can take it in a lot of different directions, and the movies do. And usually it involves some kind of transformation of one kind or another where something happens to that person or people as they are along the road. And it's been a natural form of movies for quite a while, and there's something about a movie and the linear nature of a movie, the way that film strip goes through the projector looking like a road that you might travel on. Not in the digital age, I guess we have to forget all that. But
that was good, though.
But there's something about it that just lends itself to that kind of episodic thing, and I'm always a sucker for that.
I am too. There are two road movies coming out.
Yeah.
What are they? What are these films you speak of?
Yeah, there happen to be two movies opening on Friday, both of which begin in Florida. I don't know why, but that's just a coincidence. One of them is called Arthur Newman, a film with starring Colin Firth and Emily Blunt, two fine British actors, both doing American accents here. And Colin Firth is playing a role. It's kind of that wish fulfillment thing of a guy who has reached a certain point in life, is very disappointed in his life, and decides that he will just erase it and start again, and takes on literally a new identity, a new name, buys a car, and just starts driving. And it's a nice idea. I'll always look at a movie that's about that subject as something that sort of strikes a deep chord there. Unfortunately, with Arthur Newman, which I don't think is a very good movie at all, right away he runs into the woman played by Emily Blunt, who's a little unstable, and she's got something going on, and they start role playing, and the road narrows fairly quickly. Unfortunately,
that's too bad.
Whatever it is they're doing.
What was Suddenly Seeking Susan? Desperately Seeking Susan. Was that the one with Madonna and
Rosanna Arquette? I think was in that one.
Was that a road movie? I'm thinking of a different one.
Well, I haven't thought of that movie in a long time.
It sounded like that. I mean, these road movies. For example, I was looking at lists of road movies and best road movies of all time, and there was one that I thought, well, all right, that is a simple idea for a road movie, but is it correct? Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, that's a road movie.
That
to be
qualifies,
sure.
Yeah. Much of it is not on the road, but it feels like it.
But Blues Brothers 2000, what do you think?
I don't know.
They were hitchhiking, so that's what makes it a road movie.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm wondering, a road movie has to be about some sort of quest, doesn't it? In the end, you have to be searching for something.
Or escaping something.
Or escaping something.
Yeah.
But it can't be as narrow as, I mean, they have to be good, they have to go beyond just, I'm on the road to this place. I'm on the road to this place, and here's what I learn about myself along the way. Here's what I discovered. it has to be transformational, like
I think
said.
So. Yeah.
Like
yeah, I think something has to happen, unless the point of it is somehow that this person doesn't evolve or doesn't learn the lessons of the road or whatever. Or you could have a more kind of existential road movie where the purpose of it might be a little murkier. The classic being Two-Lane Blacktop. That
was murky.
That early 70s, very much a product of its era, but kind of a fascinating film that gets under your skin even though you don't really know necessarily. It doesn't give you a lot of clues about what the meaning of it all might be or what, if anything, anybody has learned.
Well, there were quite a few road movies in the 60s that were kind of like that or, mm-hmm. or Zabriskie Point.
Yes. Vanishing Point.
Vanishing Point.
Easy Rider, of course, is a road movie that caught the imagination of everybody.
But that's the classic one, isn't it? I mean, Easy Rider is they're on a quest. They learn things. They have a transformational character with Jack Nicholson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then things don't end well.
They do not end well. And Nicholson's character really expresses that when he's the ordinary character in the movie, not like those hippies who are out there. He's more average, but when he gets wind of the fact that they are just going to head down to New Orleans, he goes along with it. It's like, boy, that sounds like fun. He's the audience. He can't resist the idea of just going along for that journey.
So we pulled some clips from a few things before we get to the second new movie. Here's a clip from a recent but clearly a classic road movie. This is a bit of the trailer from Thelma and Louise.
Thelma.
I'll get it!
Thelma, I've not told you. I can't stand it when you holler in the morning.
I'm sorry, doll. I just didn't want you to be late.
Louise.
Yeah, I still have to ask Daryl if I can go.
You mean you haven't asked him yet?
Thelma, is he your husband or your father?
Thelma and Louise are going fishing.
How come Daryl let you go?
Because I didn't ask him.
He's going to kill you!
I left him a note.
Thelma and Louise are going to catch hell.
I'll have a wild turkey straight up and a Coke back, please.
Thelma!
Oh, what? Tell me something. Is this my vacation or isn't it?
They were on vacation. They were on the road, Thelma and Louise.
Turned into something kind of interesting by the end there with that film.
Which is what makes a good road movie, right? You're surprised.
Yeah. It's. And the way that one wound up certainly was surprising.
Well, just hold hands and go over the cliff together.
Yeah.
What was the other movie that's opening now that's a road movie?
The other film that's opening on Friday, a Florida road movie, is called Sun Don't Shine. And it's a very micro indie production that is directed by an actress who's starting to have some make some waves. Her name's Amy Simetz. She's not in the film, but she was in a locally made film called The Off Hours, which is directed by Megan Griffiths, and she was terrific in that. And she is in the current film Upstream Color, another micro indie that is a sort of mystifying movie, but kind of interesting too. And Sun Don't Shine is very much in that spirit. It's very close to two young people who have obviously done something bad that they need to be escaping to the road for at the beginning of the film. And we don't find out everything about them right away, but we will eventually. But it's very much a mood piece, atmosphere piece, this sort of sweltering funk of Florida in the midsummer and these people who aren't particularly well-suited to be around each other, I think, and yet have some sort of bond. It's not a conventional film where Arthur Newman is all too conventional, and this one is definitely unconventional. You have to be a certain kind of road movie enthusiast, I suppose, to go along with this one. I have the feeling that the filmmaker maybe found the two main characters more interesting than I did, but as a piece of as a slice of just pure place and atmosphere, I found it really persuasive.
Robert Horton is our guest. He is the film critic for the Herald and Everett, now appearing in the Seattle Weekly as well.
So they tell me. The people may have heard that the company that bought the Weekly a while back recently bought the Herald. The Herald had been owned for the 30 years that I've been writing for it by the Washington Post, and they decided to divest, and so now the Herald and the Weekly are under the same banner, so some of my reviews are going to be running in the Weekly as well.
Oh, good. He is also the host of the Magic Lantern, a series of discussions of cinema at the Fry Art Museum. He also hosts a series of discussions at Northwest Film Forum, and he writes at the Crop Duster. Here's a clip from another movie. This is a movie, Sideways.
Here's my last week of freedom.
We're going to play some golf, eat some great food, and we're going to send you off in style.
It's going to be great.
Tonight, we are celebrating Miles' book deal, published author.
Oh, what's the title?
The Day After Yesterday.
Oh. You guys should stay for the weekend.
No, we have to get back for the rehearsal dinner.
What rehearsal dinner?
You're getting married on Saturday!
Day After Yesterday.
Yes.
She didn't like that. Now, I had a debate with myself, okay, and perhaps I will have it with you all as well, because our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Great road movies, the tradition of road movies. What's your favorite? What do you learn from it? Why do you like them? 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869, or email weekday at kuow.org, road movies. Is Sideways, Robert Horton, a road movie? Does it qualify?
I think I can go with it as a road movie. Yeah, it's not a journey into the unknown, because these two guys who are going to look at some wineries and all that know where they're going. But it ends up, I think it ends up being a road movie. Yeah,
I remember that scene where he's outside that hotel. I can't remember, but he's in the wine country. He's outside the hotel and he's drunk, and the sun is setting, and the cars are whizzing by, and he's right by the neon sign. That would be, that's why I said, okay.
That's a nice image from a road movie.
Yeah, that's a good quintessential road movie. Yeah.
It's a film that's, the director of the film, Alexander Payne, seems to be drawn to road movies. I think his upcoming film is actually a road movie, but he also is the guy who did About Schmidt, which is has Jack Nicholson as a new widower who kind of fumbles his way onto the road without really knowing exactly what he's doing.
Well, then I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
Because I thought that sort of answers my call for a road movie that's transformational, or if it's not transformational, it fails to be transformational. Here's a little clip from About Schmidt.
As for me, I'm headed back to Omaha. I'm driving straight through this time, and I've made only one stop. The impressive new arch over the interstate in Kearney, Nebraska.
I took an Indian bride myself.
You've really got to see it to believe it. And it kind of got me thinking. Looking at all that history and reflecting on the achievements of people long ago kind of put things into perspective. I know we're all pretty small in the big scheme of things. And I suppose the most you can hope for is to make some kind of difference. But what kind of difference have I made? What in the world is better because of me?
Ouch, huh? I mean, there's the road movie sort of question as you're driving down the road and getting dark at night.
Yeah, and one of the nice things about Schmidt is the way its road trip is fairly modest. He doesn't do the great things, you know. He just kind of gets out there, maybe has some very minor revelations, but they're human revelations, and that's why we're with him.
Yeah,
he doesn't go very far. He's going to a wedding, but
he learns a lot.
But he learns something. He has some kind of experience, and plus it's really awesome that it's Jack Nicholson who we were with on Easy Rider.
Yeah,
going down that same road.
Here a few of your thoughts about good road movies and what they mean. Jackie's in Tulalip, Motorcycle Diaries. That's classic in terms of its movement, isn't it, Jackie?
Oh, it was an amazing movie, and the movement that it produced was historical.
Yeah. You saw Motorcycle Diaries too, didn't you, Robert?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you feel like you were on the trip with them? That was one of the things people talked about, Jackie, that when Motorcycle Diaries, you were taking the trip with those guys.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I've traveled a lot in South America, so it was brought back some other memories. So it was a very good movie.
What memory did it bring back for you? Was it also a road memory?
No, it wasn't really a road memory. It was more scenery.
Jackie, thanks. I appreciate that. So here's another one. Here, let me ask Chris. Chris, what was your road movie?
Tu Mama Tambien.
Oh yeah. What do you remember from that movie? What sort of scene on the road do you remember from that movie?
Well, a couple of things that answer the question of the destination and the experience of the two guys that sort of came of age, and the woman who had some serious health issues. And I also spent quite a bit of time in Mexico and have been on that same road trip, driven all over Mexico. And that was my movie that I said, oh, I know that place and I know this place. So for me, it was a huge experience and a funny, funny movie.
That's one of the things good about a road trip, too, is it takes you. You're on the trip again that you've taken in the past, but through somebody else's eyes. And that's always fun. Thank you for that. And let me ask Art on Vashon, Lost in America, Albert Brooks, Lost in America?
That's the one.
What?
I thought that was a terrific film. It was, I loved the storyline. You know, a young couple gets tired of the scene in L.A., and they've done quite well for themselves. They get onto they get an RV and start heading off across the country. And
that's right.
I think she loses the nest egg.
The nest egg, you know, she's
Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's right.
And then their struggles begin, and it's just hysterical. It's also quite poignant, and I just kind of love the. Well, I didn't really love it, but you know, in the end, they end up getting to New York, where he takes a. Except sort of a mid-level job, getting has to get back to work. The dream is over. So.
Yeah, and he has to beg for his old job back too. That's right. Hey, Art, thanks.
Well, it's a great one because of the it's very self-conscious about the idea of the road movie. And Albert Brooks's character is full of that spirit, and he's going to go, and it's going to be something new. And they don't get very far, and they lose the nest egg, and that's really the end of the open road idea. Except it's kind of not. It still serves some kind of function, but it's a really nice variation on the road movie because it's not as romantic as you think it is.
All right. So Rob in Renton has one that you'll appreciate too. Hi, Rob.
Hi.
What's your road movie?
Kings of the Road, Wim Wenders.
Yeah, part of his trilogy, right? Isn't that part of the trilogy?
That I don't know. I know that there was Alice in the City, which was sort of more of a train movie. But, I haven't seen any of them for many years, but Kings of the Road was one of the first foreign films I'd seen that really just had a totally different atmosphere from the American movies and gave me real appreciation for foreign films, and also for Wim Wenders. I became an instant fan.
Wasn't Bruno Ganz wasn't he a truck driver in that?
Is he in that? Or, well, I think one of Wenders' other leading men is in that.
It's not
guy
Ganz?
A guy named Rudiger Völker.
Oh, is that right?
But it is a classic road movie, yes, for sure, and it's 3 hours long, and It unfolds at a kind of a lulling pace that feels exactly right by the time you're 15 minutes into it or so, and you're just on the road with these two guys in Europe, and it's a wonderful movie. And yeah, Wenders is one of the filmmakers who loves the road, and his production company is called Road Movies.
You're right,
always has been.
You're right, of course. It was Rudiger. What's his last
Vogler?
Name? Vogler, yeah, Rudiger Vogler. And the third one, so is Alice in the City's the Kings of the Road, and then The Wrong Move.
Yeah,
those are his road movie trilogy.
People kind of lump it as a road movie trilogy, although he keeps going back to the road. I mean, Paris, Texas is in some ways kind of a road movie. Although it's sort of an after road movie.
You have Local Hero on your list as a road movie.
I wrote a few things down. Yeah, and so I was thinking about Transformation. It's not a road movie after a certain point, but it does become one. Just it's kind of. I was thinking of things that were kind of in the spirit of road movies, even if they aren't always on the road. And that was one of them. And Johnny Depp, the film he made with Jim Jarmusch, Dead Man, is a Western that's kind of a road movie. It's a very unusual Western, but it follows along this idea of transformation as his journey goes along. Very strange journey it is, too.
All right. I just wanted to play a little bit from one of my favorite road shows. TV shows sort of lend themselves to that sometime. And this is the beginning from an old TV show called Then Came Bronson, where he's a guy on a motorcycle traveling the country. It might be a little hard to hear, but he's pulling up next to a guy at a stoplight, and the guy in the sort of the button-down guy in the car says, "Hey, where are you heading?" He goes, "Oh, you know, just up ahead." And the guy says, "Wow, I wish I was you." And Bronson goes, "Yeah, well, hang in there," and then motors off. I just like that notion. We, a friend of mine, always make that joke because you know, I wish I was you. Yeah, just taking off.
Mm-hmm.
We're just taking off. All right, Roberto.
Michael Parks, the actor, not to be confused with your business.
That's right, Michael J. Parks.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's actually the same guy.
Is that right? He's been on the road a long time. Yeah.
All right. We shall watch for these road movies as we hit the road, sir.
Yes.
Talk to you in some months.
I'll see you out there.
Yeah, I'll see you out there on the road. Just hang in there.
Going down that long, lonesome highway, bound for the mountains and the plains. Sure ain't nothing here gonna tie me, and I got some friends I'd like to see again.
Hello, this is Dave Beck. KUW is grateful to everyone who participated in our recent spring membership drive. Now it's time to close our books. So if you've mailed in your pledge payment, thank you very much. If not, please send in your payment today. And thanks for supporting Public Radio, KUOW.
1041. We'll get some insight into the Puget Sound business scene in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 58 degrees in Seattle, looking at a high today of 68 with lots of sun. Overnight, maybe a few clouds with a low of 46, but tomorrow Thursday, sunny again with a high of 64.
Support for KUOW comes from Zoo Tunes, featuring John Prine, Randy Newman, Trombone Shorty, Brandy Carlisle, and more. Tickets, complete show calendar, and more at zoo.org/zootunes.
Vice President Biden spoke today at the memorial service for Sean Collier, the MIT police officer who was killed last week during the manhunt for the Boston Marathon bombers. More about that memorial service in the news at 11.
John Talton is here to talk about what's happening in the economy right now, of which it could be. We could be excited about Seattle's unemployment. We could be concerned about the fact that Boeing is, though doing well, it's losing some... losing some orders, and at the same time, who knows where they'll be building those planes. John Talton is economics columnist for the Seattle Times. He blogs as Rogue Columnist at roguecolumnist.com, author of 10 mystery and thriller novels, of which next Tuesday we are going to talk about your latest.
Thank you, short timer.
I look forward to doing that. Well, you're my inspiration for writing novels.
Well,
but you, however, are able to do it while you keep a day job.
Well, that's another $92 in the bank account.
Well, that's impressive. First of all, speaking of movies, you saw Oblivion, and what was your response to the movie Oblivion?
Well, I thought it was like my columns in that it was incoherent, but I enjoyed it.
That's what people tell you about your columns as well.
Exactly. And remember the columnist's motto, frequently wrong, but never in doubt.
Yeah, I think I'm going to use that for my next radio show. You know, that'll be what we say about weekday from now on. Frequently wrong, never in doubt. Did you hear the story this morning about the drop in some people dropping back on their orders for Boeing planes?
Yeah, I don't think it's surprising. I think Wall Street was overall happy with Boeing's performance. And since Boeing is the last commercial airline maker in America and so tied into the defense market, if there is any company in America that is too big to fail, it is Boeing.
Wow, that's a remarkable thought, isn't it? Well, they'll be competing with the Japanese soon, right? And the Chinese as well.
Well, the Japanese have re-entered the airline market with a small jet. It's kind of like the little Canadair planes. The big competitive threat on the horizon is China. But that is a distance off. I mean, Boeing's biggest enemy is Boeing, we just have to hope and pray that this time they've got the Dreamliner right.
Well, how about that? The plane could be going back in the air real soon.
Well, the company has tremendous political power, and it can exert that to get the FAA to speed things along. But I think the regulators and the company both want to make sure that this is done right and that there are no more screw-ups because they're already facing these clawback demands from some customers who have lost money with the plane being grounded.
The NTSB is still providing more scrutiny. They want a little more reassurance, right, that this fix is the fix.
Well, Debbie Herzman, who's the head of the NTSB, is
National Transportation Safety Board.
Correct. She is a real regulator and is much more of a tough sell than anybody else. And if she signs off on it, then I think we can have more confidence.
Now, I know we've discussed this, and you've written about it, but you have looked at Boeing's decisions about where they're going to manufacture or where they may manufacture, where they're investing money to manufacture, is the best way to put it. Have you heard of anybody saying in response to your column about what's the future for Boeing, what's the future for us? Has anybody sort of laid out a plan for the next 20 years in our manufacturing system?
Well, Mr. Hamilton, the famed aviation analyst at Liam Companies, has been in a hair-on-fire moment for quite some time, saying that the South represents the biggest competitive threat to the Puget Sound remaining a premier aerospace cluster. And having covered General Motors back in the 80s, I was in Dayton, Ohio, which was the second largest concentration of General Motors employees in the world. And today there are none there. And Flint, Michigan was number one, and today there are none there. And so people say to me, well, you know, how could you possibly say that Boeing, with 85,000 Washington State employees and South Carolina getting 6,000, could be any kind of a competitive threat to the Puget Sound region? Well, partly because I lived through that. And I don't think we can take anything for granted. Boeing, like these transnational corporations, will bid states off against each other for more incentives. We gave $3 billion to get the Dreamliner assembly, and they've still put one in South Carolina. And right now things are going well. There's enough work to go around, but when it comes time for cutbacks, will those cutbacks come disproportionately here? I just don't think we can take anything for granted. This is not the Boeing of 30 years ago.
But what's the response? Like, what response would you like to see from economic planners or policymakers, if there's one for them to have?
I think it is a very difficult situation. The governor has got to pay attention and be in constant contact with Boeing. But it's not as if we haven't done anything. Under Governor Locke, we did the 787 incentives. We have two senators who may as well be, Senator Patty Murray, D. Boeing, Senator Maria Cantwell, D. Boeing. So it's not like this is some high tax, high regulation state that hates Boeing and never does anything for them. But Boeing, headquartered in Chicago, McDonnell Douglas used Boeing's money to take Boeing over. They hate me every time I say that, but it's just the truth. You have this mentality in the corporate headquarters that is seeded by Jack Welch's proteges who run the company. They want to be diversified. They want to be an international company. They do not want to be the Boeing that is so heavily concentrated in the Puget Sound. Now, you could argue that on the one hand, that's a good and healthy thing. I mean, why would you want to be in a place that is at risk of earthquakes and volcano explosions when you could move to a place that can get Category 5 hurricanes? But on the other hand, there's a tremendous number of sunk costs here. And you have the greatest concentration of aerospace talent in the world here. And so it would be very foolish to not reinvest heavily in the Puget Sound. It would be almost as foolish as taking the most advanced airliner in the history of aviation and outsourcing it to all of these companies around the world with minimal oversight of what they're actually going to build for you.
Well, it's a good thing that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Is there something, you know, Jay Inslee has talked, as he got elected, his argument was, let's be innovators. Let's look for where we can seed new companies, new technologies to help companies grow. You know, if you have this strong aerospace core, there are clearly people here who have new and innovative ideas that might be nurtured. But is this a role for government?
Well, it can be. I mean, we have one of the largest Airbus supplier clusters here in the world, and most people don't know that. So it's not just a Boeing town, and we need to leverage that. Government needs to pay attention to the burdens it's putting on businesses. It needs to pay attention to the roadblocks that it could get out of the way. It needs to watch best practices around the country that can help innovation happen. But one of the biggest things that it has to do is make sure that it retains one of the world's great public research universities and doesn't cut it down to being just another something I can't say on national public radio level of a state college. And that's something that Olympia just does not seem to get its head around.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to hear how this debate will unfold just for this budget, by any means, in terms of funding for education as a whole and for higher ed as well.
Well, Washingtonians do not want to pay taxes, and Washingtonians want all the benefits of government.
Well, we'll just have to learn that you can't have both. Cannot have your cake and eat it, too.
I want a pony.
All right, you asked a question about our unemployment in this state. Much of the rest of Washington still has high unemployment. Seattle unemployment is down. You said 5.5%. You said, is this the great divergence?
I think it is. I think we are a living example of the great divergence, where in the aftermath of, I'm going to call it the panic of 2008. I'm so sorry I ever bought into this great recession stuff, because we'll have worse on the way. And it also trivializes the Great Depression.
So wait, are you agreeing with my friend David Stockman, who basically was arguing that it was a completely trumped up financial problem for the Wall Street banks, and they got the rest of us to buy into that panic?
Well, I mean, my friend Dave Stockman helped seed this problem 30 years ago. So, I mean, pot meet kettle. No, it's just that it was a financial panic and a bubble, and I don't know if I want to call it the Great Recession anymore, but coming out of this, we have cities like Seattle and Austin that are doing incredibly well. We have people who are, say, you know, highly paid software engineers who are doing incredibly well. And then we have other cities and states that still have very, very high unemployment. Even in Washington State, we have, by the widest measure, something like 16.5% unemployment when you factor in the people who can't get full-time work but want it, the people who have had to drop out of the workforce. Our workforce participation has gone down. Unemployment is still relatively high in Pierce County. And so you have the rich got much richer in the Great Recession. Oops, I said it. And the poor got much poorer. We have economic mobility at a standstill. This is the discontinuity that has been my hobby horse for the past 10 years or so that is our future. This is not going to be like the past 25 years going forward. And so, yeah, Seattle is at a point where you can say we've almost reached full employment. The rest of the state, much of the country, not.
I mean, in a sense, this is connected back to what you were saying about Boeing and about investments, but is it also connected to, are you saying this is, and other writers have said it, this is a structural problem. This is where this economy and these developed economies are heading, because the growth and therefore the opportunity is in the emerging economies.
Well, that is what the corporatists would have you believe, but it is also a problem that has been brought on by policy. where you have corporations perfectly legal avoiding taxes, and so we're not able to invest in our schools. We've made a lot of bad trade agreements, which may benefit some in Washington State to a tremendous amount. But if you look nationally, we've lost millions and millions of good blue-collar manufacturing jobs.
Are you talking like NAFTA, things like that, and other free trade agreements?
Absolutely. And so we're, you know, we have a free trade agreement with Korea, but Korea still heavily subsidizes its industry. It has this incredibly incestuous relationship between government and industry. It plays currency games just like China, but we beat up China about that. We never talk about South Korea. And yet we're in this quote-unquote free trade agreement. That's not going to redound to our benefit in many new jobs. And so we – and then Clyde Prestowitz, who's the great trade analyst, has talked about how we're playing tennis while China and these other Asian countries are playing football. It's not a case of, you know, one side is cheating or not. It's just that we're not playing the actual game that has to be played.
Vali Nasser, who's an analyst, a diplomatic analyst, argued that the China is pursuing policies and trade agreements around the world that are mercantilist and that are focused on China succeeding by investing a little bit in other countries, but not expanding their prosperity as much as the U.S. His implication was that the U.S. had done when it invested in Europe or other countries. I don't know if I see the distinction as much. Do you?
Sure. I mean, the United States Navy patrols the 10,000-mile supply chain by which China prospers. The People's Liberation Army Navy, and that's what it's called, does not do that. We do that. And so they and the European Union are free riders on us. And so China is rising to a world superpower but not shouldering world superpower responsibilities.
Well, we don't want to let them.
Well, I mean, a peaceful rise is a good thing. We can, you know, raise the ghost of Theodore Roosevelt and he can talk about that. But mercantilism is alive and well in China and much of Asia. One example is that the machine tools that as late as the 1990s were made here, highly precision devices made by a highly skilled workforce in the Midwest, almost all of that has gone to China. And the reason is that China says you want to sell here, you've got to set up a factory here. Well, that's not the way free trade is supposed to work. That's not the way Alexander Hamilton set it up.
But you know that the people who are critics of that say, oh, no, the problem was that we were paying those workers too much in the Midwest.
Well, if we want to lower our living standards to that of the average Chinese worker, the people who are committing suicide at Foxconn, we can do that, and we're headed that way. But that's not going to be the zenith of the American middle class that some old guy like me actually remembers.
And, of course, you're not buying houses in China at the level we are here, even though houses are there. They're not buying cars. They're not buying all the other things that have come from the benefit of higher wages.
Well, exactly. And so these trade agreements are simply not working, and we have these huge imbalances. So we owe all this money to the Chinese, which causes the debt and deficit people to get the fantods. In fact, the Chinese are a lot more in trouble over that than we are. I mean, we can just default, you know, and the world will still lend us money. I mean, you know, we're a borrower with the greatest military in the history of the world behind us. You're not going to run our credit card through? I think you will.
All right, I left you absolutely no time. So next time, you'll have to talk about the value of if there's a value in a stadium district in economic terms.
Can't wait.
All right. Well, we'll do it. We'll touch on it when we talk about your novel on Tuesday.
Thank you.
John Talton is economics columnist for the Seattle Times. He also blogs as Rogue Columnist at roguecolumnist.com. We will talk to you again tomorrow on this fine program establishment. We're going to talk to Isabel Allende about her work and also a conversation with President Obama's sister. Join us.
10:59. The New York Police Department has a plan to study how chemical weapons could be dispersed through the air into the New York City subway system. They're planning some tests this summer. More about that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. This is a test of the emergency alert system. The emergency alert system.
Hip-hop's current obsessions, according to rapper Talib Kweli.
We're in our rock and roll phase, you know, sex, drugs, and party, 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 party.
But Kweli says don't be fooled by what you hear in the mainstream.
Hip-hop is preoccupied with life. You can find...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.